The title of the sermon today is going to be The Race of Faith. And if I could, please, could I get a volunteer to read Hebrews 11, 29 through 40? And so we see that the writer of Hebrews uses the context of those who ran the race of faith in the Old Testament. And he then instructs us on how we should go about running our own race with endurance and joy. So we are encouraged to consider Jesus' earthly ministry, looking towards Jesus who guides us as we straighten our paths walking with God. And as we grow closer to God, he acknowledges us as sons and corrects us through his discipline. And his love for us exceeds our understanding at times, but we see the fruits of our endurance as we abide in the love of God. And so we are going to be in Hebrews 12, 1 through 13. And verse 1 says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." And so we see therefore here, and it brings in the passage of scripture that Jordan just read. And they describe these wits of faith and how God delivered them despite their tribulation, despite their flaws and their weaknesses. So we see that they surround us and they are a great cloud. We also see that they are in an incomplete state. They did not receive what was promised, but they are waiting for us and watching as we are running our race just as they did. And so their perfection is contingent on our running. So we see that Moses is a witness, Daniel is a witness, Joseph, with these, all these people are witnesses of our personal race. And we see we are placed here in exactly this part of the race. And so we kind of get this picture that those that have ran before us have passed on the baton of faith. And so now we sit here with the baton in our own hands. We are instructed to run our race efficiently and prepare by laying aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Now, the Greek word for weight here is also used as body, pride, or self-importance. And it says the sin which clings so closely. So we see that the sin here is sticky, that it clings to us. And some interpretations might translate clinging closely as ensnaring or besetting. And so we see that the sin is a trap. And so it clings to us almost to the point where we think that it is a part of us. And the enemy will tell us the lie that is just who we are. We can't, there's nothing we can do about it. It's just a part of us. It's who we are. But that is a lie. And we are called to lay these things aside. Now, the author left sin here in the largest context possible because he is talking about all sin. Sin circles around us and it is lying, waiting and lurking for us. We see in Hebrews 11, 24 through 25, it says, "By faith, when he had grown up, Moses refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin." And so we see how Moses laid aside the sin which was available to him, and he had faith that God would deliver his people. Looking at the later half of verse 1, it says, "Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Now notice how he says the race. We are all in a singular race. It's the same race that the Old Testament saints ran. It is the same race that is going on today, and it's the same race that will go until the end of time. So he also instructs us to run with endurance. And now this word endurance could also mean steadfastness or constancy. And so we get this idea of perseverance. So we are to run with perseverance the race that is set before us. And he says set before us because God has given us a lane in this race. He has given us a purpose that he has intended us to fulfill. And Paul knew full well of this race also. Listen to 1 Corinthians 9:24. It says, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it." And Paul wanted the church at Corinth to know about this race and be aware that we are to be constantly running towards the prize. And during the Greek times, that the only kind of races they probably would have was the Greek games. And during the Greek games, runners would actually run naked so that nothing was holding them back. No clothes was holding them back. They were at their full speed. And so we kind of get this picture that the writer of Hebrews is kind of looking to that we are to strip everything that is holding us back and run with endurance. The race is almost like a marathon, where we are to not sprint, but run with endurance. To be born again enlists every believer as a runner that should be running. God has described this life as a race to his people in his word, and this is how we are to approach it. We are in the same race as all people of faith, and they had to get rid of their sins just as we do. Races include elements of time, and our race is currently now. We have the baton in our hands. These weights could also mean human pursuits and human indulgences. Even though they may not cause us to sin, they are not beneficial to us. I know I like to play the game, and so I spend hours on hours just playing the game when I'm not really achieving. I'm achieving an imaginary goal or imaginary points. So we see like these things are things that are basically a waste of time because they benefit not the kingdom or they really don't benefit us very much. And a couple of these things might be social media, sports, money, video games, whatever it may be. It's just this idea of things that don't necessarily matter. Francis Chan said, "Our greatest fear should not be of failure, but of succeeding at things in life that don't really matter." And so here these weights are things that we need to shed, which hold us back and which aren't very necessary. And we fall behind in this race when we sin. Listen to Galatians 5:7. "You were running a good race. Who cut in on you to keep you from obeying the truth?" And so we see that sin distracts us from what's really important. So we too must run with endurance. We are to run with steadfast endurance. Now this endurance should be the main thing that is driving us. It should be our engine, if you will. It is the thing that should drive us until the end where we are supposed to be going. And so we see that God is more concerned about our direction rather than our speed. He wants us to seek him first. And so we should be asking ourselves, how's our race going? So now that we see that we are supposed to join those who ran well before us by responding to the life with endurance, let's turn our attention to the model racer we are supposed to focus on while we are running. He continues in verse 2 saying, "Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." Now notice this is all one sentence. Verse 1 and 2 are still the same sentence. And so he's saying that as we are running our race, as we are in our lane, as we are laying aside these things, we are to be looking to Jesus as our gaze focuses on him and not what the world has for us. Not what the world is tempting us with or trying to conform us to. But we look on him how to run well. And it says he is the founder and perfecter of our faith. Founder here could also be translated as author or leader. And so we see that he began our race and he also completes our race. And he will complete our faith in the day of glory. Philippians 1:6 says, "And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ." And so we see really he does all the heavy lifting for us. He began it for us. He encourages us as we run and he will complete it. So that should be our greatest hope, that he will complete it. No matter how hard we run, no matter how slow we run, he will complete it at the day of glory. It then says, "Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross." And so we see that for the joy, Jesus endured the cross because he knew his purpose here. And he knew that as he was being crucified, he was giving glory to God until the end. He knew his purpose here, and we should follow this. It says, "despising the shame and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." And so we see that he ran because of his purpose for his heavenly reward. He is seated at the right hand of God because he endured until the end. And so we should also follow in his steps and leave our treasures in heaven rather than on earth. Verse 3 goes on to say, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. So we are to ponder what Barclay called the standard of comparison. And so we are to ponder how he suffered versus how we suffer. We are to ponder how perfect he was, yet how poorly they treated him, with how evil we are, yet how gracious God is with us. The reason is so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. We are not to be discouraged when we are facing persecution or struggles in life. Even Jesus did. So we are to be encouraged because he lived a perfect life yet received the worst punishment. He reinforces this in verse 4 saying, in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And so this word struggle here literally means to fight agonizingly against. And so we see that in our struggle against the world, we have not shed blood. Jesus died, but we have not dropped any blood. And also the church that the writer is writing to, obviously they have, whatever their persecution was, it was bloodless. And so common persecution in the first century might have been imprisonment or being mocked or being run out of town. But it wasn't a matter of life or death. And so we are to be encouraged by the heroes that came before us and ran before us to see how they endured such hostility and see how Jesus endured such hostility yet endured to the end. And I think it's interesting how it says to resist, but Jesus did not resist being put on the cross because he knew what was being fulfilled. And so we are to mimic his resistance with integrity because he had integrity in what he believed in and what he was doing. And so when they think of the heroes of the past, we think of what they did to make their faith possible and what they did to bring their faith to fruition. And this should encourage us. 21st century persecution is for the American is almost non-existent. But we know that there are those in other countries that aren't as lucky. And I think we should just be encouraged that despite, even though they are going through this, like they have something more to hope for. And we also do. Our main struggle, though, might be giving up time, sitting at church for an hour and a half, so hard, or we got to give our energy. But these are things that are very minuscule compared to what Jesus had to go through. So this should be an encouragement for us to continue to walk and run by faith. And we see that this life is going somewhere. There is a cause, and God's will be done. And we want to be a part of that. We are encouraged to keep the kingdom at the forefront of our minds, despite our trials, despite our tribulations, despite our errors. We focus on the heavenly. We are to endure easier circumstances because our Lord endured the hardest, coming from heaven to flesh and then being brought into a Roman cross where criminals are supposed to be crucified. Charles Spurgeon says, what a shameful thing it is that while you are bold about everything else, you are cowardly towards Jesus Christ. Brave for the world and cowardly towards Jesus. So how can we compare what he went through with what we go through? If we will run well, we must run light. And if we will run light, we must look to Jesus. So now that we have seen that we are looking to Jesus on how he executed his race, let us turn and look at how the Father is helping us in ours. Look in verse 5. It says, and have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. And so we get this picture of he is disciplining us like a father does a child to strengthen us and lift us up and correct us. It is a symbol of his love to us. He reinforces this in verse 6 saying, for the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. Now, discipline primarily is used in training children. Chastises literally means to scourge or lash or flog. And so it could be interpreted as the Lord disciplines, the Lord trains the one he loves and scourges every son he receives. And so we see two aspects of God's discipline. There's a whisper and a whip. If we don't hear him the first time, we will hear him the second time. And the word does not have in it the idea of punishment, but of corrective measures which will eliminate evil in the life and encourage the good. He does not view us as a criminal anymore, because Jesus has atoned for our punishment that we deserve. Instead, it is restored into a relationship of father and son, where he nurtures us and strengthens us and grows us. So we see how we are to consider how Jesus endured, and we're also to remember the exhortation that we are children of God. And so we are to be encouraged by how Jesus endured and how God is acting in our lives through love, through discipline. He reinforces this in verse 7, saying, "It is for discipline that you have to endure. For God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline?" And so the writer of Hebrews is encouraging the church to remain under the chastening hand of God for the purpose of correction. He does not cast us off, which we deserve, because we are his children. And so we would better hope that we are being disciplined, because in verse 8 he says, "If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they discipline us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness." And so he warns us against taking discipline the wrong way. If we are without discipline, we are not children of God. But we are. And David Guzik wrote, "We all do not know by experience what a model father is, but we all know by intuition what a good father is. And God is that perfect father, and he gives us this intuition. So when one feels cheated or disappointed by a bad father, it is because they intuitively compare them to our good father in heaven." So we are to trust that his discipline is growing us even when we do not see it. Discipline done wrongly by our earthly fathers is due to their lack of insight, but God's discipline is perfect. He is always divine. Now, it may be painful rather than pleasant, but it makes us fruitful and keeps us from failure. It trains us and doesn't taint us. And those who have been trained by it have peace and righteousness. So the presence of this discipline in our lives should be a mark of God's love. And our response to this discipline determines our fruit. Our lack of response determines our failure. So we must mature in our faith through suffering that we may share God's holiness. Finishing in verse 12 and 13, it says, "Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather healed." So he using "therefore" again to sum up everything he just said into this point. He's wanting us to pull ourselves together and run straight, conserving our energy and staying focused on Jesus. Instead of drooping hands and weak knees, the audience is encouraged to handle the discipline they are receiving from the Lord in the right way. We have to be grateful for his discipline. They are to make their path straight and align with God's will as a response to this discipline, rather than growing bitter and being mad at God. So we are called to run this race with good form, conscious of how we move, not swaying or wavering to the left or the right. But we are staying straight in our path, finishing at the finish line. I used to run track, and so, like, The coach, all every time you get to the finish line, they like run all the way through, run all the way through. And if you kind of, when you get to the end, start walking, do a little jog, run again. So we are to run all the way, full head of steam, through the finish line. It says, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather healed. So when I see what is lame, I think of brokenness. I think of my sinfulness. We have two choices, either let God heal it or let it be out of joint. And when we respond to his discipline by allowing him to heal these broken parts in our lives, we are not doing the work ourselves. We are letting God do it. Because if we do it, it'd be out of joint. And so with this discipline, we must choose and act with our mind and with our will. We see that Jesus has restored our relationship with God through his sacrifice, not so that we may stay broken, but rather healed. Not just so we can walk by faith, but so we can run by faith. And as we run, we must identify when and where God is helping us and respond to this with steadfast endurance.